This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, inside the hearts and minds of terrorists, in-depth interviews with captured jihadis offers clues as to why they chose extremism. Plus, an online service makes the hookup for animals, and the musings of a household appliance go viral on Twitter. We'll talk to the comedian tweeting as a self-aware version of the robotic vacuum cleaner, the Roomba. But we begin with toppling some myths about sex selection. Angus Bateman's mid-20th century study into the breeding habits of fruit flies concluded that females are a limiting factor in reproduction. In other words, they're choosy about mates, while males are sexually indiscriminate. Sound familiar? Bateman's paper on sexual selection has been cited nearly 2,000 times since its original publication, and his ideas have trickled into popular thinking, portrayals, and jokes about finicky, commitment-centric women and sex-crazed men, like Barney, played by Neil Patrick Harris in the sitcom How I Met Your Mother.
This is the playbook. The playbook contains every scam, con, gambit, flim-flam, stratagem, and bamboozle I've ever used or ever hoped to use to pick up chicks and give them the business.
After driving decades of subsequent research, Bateman's study had not been repeated until recently by Patricia Guadi, evolutionary biologist at UCLA, and her colleagues. After replicating the study, they discovered no evidence of sexual selection in fruit flies. So we wanted to find out if all the old jokes need to be revised. Hi, Patricia. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Virginia. Glad to be here.
Can you summarize Bateman's original study and its significance in the world of biology and sexual selection studies?
So first, what did Bateman do? What question did he ask? He asked two really simple questions. And he asked these questions of small populations of fruit flies, and he wanted to know who mated with whom and how many offspring did each of those breeders have. In order to make his observations, he used a cutting-edge method available in the 1940s. He cultured the flies so that each of the potential breeders carried a unique visible mutation. Mm-hmm. So it was a genetic parentage study. He was able, from the offspring's phenotypes, from their expressed mutations, from what he could see, to infer who mated with whom, and then he would count up the number of mates that each of the breeders had. And he found that males seemed to mate individually with many more females than individual females mated with males. He also associated with that variation within sex and the number of mates the number of offspring. So he drew a graph, and he had the number of mates on one axis and the number of offspring on the other axis, and then he had two lines on that graph, one line for females and one for males. The graph for males went up and up and up. The graph for females went to one and then flattened out. And so that was his basic observation. There was no fitness benefit for females of mating multiply, mm-hmm. but there was a fitness benefit for males, voila. And that's the reason that females are choosy and males are indiscriminate.
Well, maybe it feels natural for us to think females pick, you know, exaggerated traits of virility. The male peacock's beautiful feathers, a stag's antlers, or the alpha male gorilla beating its chest. I mean, is that why it's probably carried through in our thinking, because it's easy to believe?
You know, that's a hard question. I think it is intuitive, and I think that the intuitive path is in the air, but there are many alternative explanations, even for the fact that females do seem to watch males with big tails.
Why wasn't this study replicated after it was first published? Isn't that a central tenet in the scientific method, that a study is repeated?
Absolutely. It's part of what we're supposed to do. It's what we teach students as part of the scientific method in every one of our beginning classes. I don't know the answer to your question. I really don't know why it wasn't repeated. I've thought a lot about this. Has it been replicated? Well, yes, it might have been, and somebody might have tried to publish it, and it might not have gotten published. Or somebody might have started the replication and realized, oh my God, it's an awful lot of work, and decided it wasn't worth it. Or maybe everyone just believed it and no one tried to replicate it.
Why did you decide to replicate it?
Because I'm interested in alternative hypotheses. We thought very hard before we started it. We got everything up and running, cultured all the flies, and then we did it. And we did it because we could, ultimately.
So explain for me, if you could summarize, the difference in your methodology and Bateman's.
Well, there wasn't one, really. He didn't watch behavior. We didn't either, because he didn't. Because we didn't watch behavior, to make the inference of who mated with whom, he had to have offspring who inherited the visible mutation from both mother and from father. Now, under any expectation of who mated with whom, we should find one quarter of the offspring with a marker from mother and a marker from father. So that's what we tested. And we found significant deviation from the one quarter expected, and it was always lower. And this told us definitively that offspring who inherited a marker from mother and a marker simultaneously from father died like flies. And so that x-axis that had the number of mates on it, it had data that they were foiled, and they were foiled in this way. He overestimated the number of individuals who had zero mates, and he underestimated the number of individuals with one, two, three, four, or five mates. And so that whole axis on which basic inferences depended was messed up. He couldn't make the observation he set out to make.
Since Bateman's study, however, many other studies have followed that make assumptions about his work as conclusive. Now, should these studies be reevaluated at this point, Patricia?
I don't really think they need to be reevaluated. They do need to be replicated. The modern studies show sometimes consistency with what Bateman observed, other times not. So there's real variation in that. So I think the modern studies are probably safe.
Well, in the past, studies that have shown behavior counter to traditional sexual roles for males and females have been viewed with some skepticism. You know, should we be more open to considering a world outside of Bateman's principles?
I mean, you're asking about why we believe in Bateman's results, you know, why it's stuck. So here we have this paradigm, this worldview about the natures of males and females. Well, did I believe that? Not in the same way that many other people seem to believe it, but why? Well, I was, I was a young woman in the 60s, which might have had something to do with what I was willing to believe about the nature of women and men.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the South. I know women are competitive, so I imagine flies were. And there were other people like Sarah Hurdy writing about competitive females. Some of her stories in The Woman That Never Evolved will turn heads if you want to read some things from the 1970s about the randiness of female chimpanzees. There are many, many studies that go against the grain of Bateman. They don't get the same attention that the consistent with Bateman studies get.
So, Patricia, having looked at this with you and your colleagues, what do you infer? Could mating patterns be by chance?
That's my favorite alternative. And there are several papers published 30 years ago almost that have worked out the mathematics of chance variation on number of mates variation. And these are almost forgotten studies. So there are alternative hypotheses, some of which depend on ideas of stochastic variation or chance variation in demographic circumstances, the availability of mates, the likelihood of predation, the likelihood of survival, the population size. All of these alternative hypotheses deserve to be tested. We're so excited to be able to explain the remarkable variation that we find in some bizarre and elaborate male traits, that our methodologies have been focused on bizarre and elaborate traits. So we ask about females choosing for males for those bizarre traits. But what if males also choose females? And what if there are fitness consequences of those choices for males? So what I'm saying, if you do a test on males, why don't you do one on females? And if you do a test on females, do one on males. Level the ecological and social playing field and see what you get.
So after more than 60 years of being the dominant theoretician on sexual selection, is there any part of you that's kind of satisfied to see Angus Bateman knocked off his pedestal?
I can't quite say it that way, and I wouldn't dare conceptualize it that way myself. But as long as you have, I think there will be much greater scope for testing alternatives now that there's a possibility Bateman's conclusions might not be quite so pat.
Well, you're far more diplomatic than I, and I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you. This was fun.
L is for the way you look at me.
Patricia Gawady clearly no shrinking violet and an evolutionary biologist teaching at UCLA. She and her colleagues repeated a landmark study from the mid-20th century about sexual selection and found some problems in the data that have long shaped our views of the roles of men and women in the mating game. For more on her work and to read about Bateman's original work with fruit flies, go to the always choosy wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, online sexual selection for animals. We'll hear about the programs and people matching hard-to-breed species with potential mates. That's when Word of Mouth continues. Stay with us.
Take my heart and please don't break it. Love was made for me and you.